Welcome to the Cognac Expert Calendar Podcast, hosted by Taylor.
So today I'm very pleased to be speaking with Seth and Thérèse Bertrand from Cognac Bertrand. How are you guys doing today?
Good, thank you.
Great. We're very excited to be here again.
Likewise. It's always good to see you guys.
Yeah.
So for those listeners who might not know who you are, can you tell us a little bit about yourselves and what you do at Cognac Bertrand?
So I think I'll start and then Seth can take over. I'm Thérèse Bertrand. I'm very pleased to be here. I work with my husband, Seth, and my brother, Samuel. And the three of us have taken over our family business that comes from my grandmother's side, Monsieur and Madame Bertrand. And we are located in the Petite Fine Champagne in a small village, which is called Réaux sur Trèfle. And we try to do our best to work the land and bring the best to make the, you know, great cognacs and Pinot de Charente. So we are producers of cognac and Pinot de Charente.
So you've been doing this literally all your life, right?
No.
Well, for all intents and purposes, right?
So we exist since 1731. But yeah, we've been here for 14 years now.
13 yes. years.
13.
Long enough that we have to think about it.
Very nice. So before we get into some general questions about Cognac Bertrand, can you tell us what cognac we're tasting today?
We are tasting the Sophia Max selection number 3. This is a collaboration that we did with Cognac Expert and Sophia Max to bring a private bottling for Cognac Expert. And we worked with them together to do a blend of two cognacs. Both of them are on the order of 30, 35 years. And with Sophie and Max, we decided on what assemblage we were going to do of those two. And that's what we have in the bottle now.
Nice.
So you said that... the word assemblage, because maybe some English speakers might not understand.
Yeah, it's one of those words that I think works better in French. It's like the assemblage is the blending. I guess it sounds nicer when you say assemblage. Right.
Absolutely. Blending or mixing sounds like a lab concoction.
Right. Yeah. Assemblage is a bit more, I don't know.
It's a bit more poetic.
Poetic, yeah. I was going to say culinary, but I like poetic.
And colorful. It's like you almost can see. You can see what's...
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Nice. Yeah. So you said a second ago that you've been back at the estate for 13, 14 years. May I ask, where were you before and what brought you back to work at the family estate?
Wow, we could spend hours talking about what we've done before, but just before we came back, we were living right in the heart of the city of Madrid in Spain. So huge change.
It's a big change. We were living in Madrid before we were in Madrid for a few years. We met in Costa Rica. Okay. And we were there for a few years too. And before that, we didn't know each other. So I guess the story kind of starts in Costa Rica, right?
Yes, we can say that.
And what pulled you back to go to the Charente, rural France, we could say?
For me, it was mostly a woman.
There you go. or say the truth. Or was it really the cognac?
It was also the opportunity to build something that is our own. There's a certain satisfaction in working for yourself. And this is an opportunity that presented to us to effectively work for ourselves.
Yes. And what happened was my brother Samuel had taken over just 2-3 years before, and he was mostly working the land. And so most of our production is sold to a big house, which in our case is Hennessy. And he spoke to me and he said, Thérèse, are you interested in continuing the family brand? Because I'm mostly interested in working the land. And if you're not, I might stop the family brand. And I'm thinking, oh my God, it's such a shame because my grandfather has, and still we still have these amazing cognacs in our cellars. What's going to happen with those? And so it was really the right, at the right time, the right opportunity for us to take over and say, okay, we're going to keep the family brand living, if you can say that. Mm-hmm. And we'll come back and we'll work on being, you know, sort of well known again, because the brand sort of disappeared for a while. And so we had to do a lot of work locally and then regionally and then country-wise and then export, you know, for people to know that we are here and we try to welcome them. And we always try to teach the best we can how we work the land and how cognac is made, which is very important to us, to teach the basics.
Yeah. Okay. And so when you came back, what were some of the initial challenges that you faced? Because running a cognac house is not nothing.
No, chief among my challenges was learning how to speak French. That's kind of important. That was a steep learning curve.
Distilling also.
I learned how to run the distillery. I did that for almost 10 years. But just like with the French, it's kind of like it's a steep learning curve, but you learn by doing and you don't really leave yourself an out. You have to learn how to do it. You don't have a choice.
No choice. Yeah. Okay. And so if I understand correctly, Therese, you're in charge of sales and marketing and really taking care of the brand. Mm-hmm. Seth, you're in the cellar master, if you will. And your brother, Sam, is in charge of what goes on in the vines and distillation. Is that correct?
Right. So Samuel, his attention is the land management. So all of the vines, he's responsible for all of the employment of all of the people that we have helping us with on the team, working the vines and making sure that everything comes through to a good harvest and then production of the spirit. That's really the core of what turns the wheels of this family business on a micro scale. And what I just described is what really effectively turns the wheels of the entire economy of this part of France. It's that just multiplied thousands and thousands and thousands of times.
Okay. And so you mentioned that you work with the big houses, notably Hennessy. If I may ask, and if you can even answer, are you selling wine to them or Compte Zero, Compte Two, Compte Three? How does it work with Hennessy?
So I think that probably each relationship is unique for the wholesale business. But our understanding in general, it's that the spirit is typically going to be distilled before it is sold on to the wholesale market. It's possible to buy it as wine. It's also possible to buy it as juice.
Any step
along the chain, I guess after it's been pressed, I suppose you could buy it as grapes, but like you could buy it as juice, then you could buy it after it's wine, then you could buy it after it's clear spirit, and then you could buy it at any point of the aging year after year along the way. But typically, all of the sales are going to, or all of the transactions are going to happen by the time it's 2 years old, you could say. Like, I think our impression is that the majority of the movement in the wholesale market is with Compte Zero, Compte One, Compte Deux. After that, you can look up, I don't know if it's public, but you can look up or inquire with the Bureau National, and you can see what is the volume. They publish statistics and you can discover what is the volume of movement. And you can see, if you just look at it, it falls off a cliff after the first couple of years.
Yeah, makes sense. And so what happens in years like this year where nature's yield is more than you're allowed to actually produce? So I understand this year it's around 10 and nature will give 14 something hectoliters. What do you do in the years where nature's yield is actually a lot bigger than what you're allowed to commercialize after distillation?
Right. So every year there's something which is announced on the production side, which they call the quota. And that is like an upper limit of how much alcohol you can produce per hectare of land that you work. That's the quota system. And so it used to be that once you hit that quota, I don't know, for example, 13 hectoliters of pure alcohol per hectare, that would be something that producers would talk about. Everything is in hecto. But it used to be that if you hit that upper limit, you weren't allowed to produce anymore. You just had to basically throw it away.
And they decided to do something new now, which is called a réserve climatique. And what that means is that you're allowed to produce above the quota a certain amount extra, say 3 or 4 hectoliters more of pure alcohol per hectare. And you seal it up in a steel tank. And if it's sealed up in a steel tank, it's effectively held in stasis, because if we want to have aging, it needs to be in a barrel. It has to be touching the wood and touching the air. So if you close it in a steel tank and seal it tight against the air, then it's like held in reserve. And then if you have a year in the future where you don't arrive to your maximum quota, you're allowed to make up the difference with whatever you have in reserve or climatique. Unblock that, and that will fill up the rest of what was lacking from the production that year.
Right. Okay. So it's like a rainy day fund, but in terms of eau de vie.
Yeah. I mean, it's an insurance policy for the producer. And it's one that the producer has more agency over. It's not like, you know, we also have insurance policies for hail, for example. Like, people have insurance against that. And this is kind of the same thing. You can true up if you're lacking 1 year. And for the buyers on the other side, on the supply side, like, it kind of smooths out the supply a little bit more also. Yeah. It's, it lets it be more predictable.
Okay. And how is that decision made as to what the quota will be per year? I mean, is that a point of contention, or is it just sort of stated and everybody rolls with it?
Our impression is that
stated.
It's the actual, like, discussion or the decision making that happens is beyond my experience. It's like a different category of the market and the world of cognac. But the way we understand it is that you have kind of like the buyers on one side and the sellers on the other side. It's a market, literally. And there is a discussion between the buy side and the sell side about how much volume they want to have in the market of cognac to sell, to maintain the market, you know, the way that they want it. And, you know, you could probably replace it with anything. You know, there are markets that are made like that for anything in the world. So this is just a very particular one. It's the wholesale market.
Okay, cool. And these last, I don't know, maybe 10 years, has climate change had an impact on the difference between the yield and the quota? Like, are you finding that more often you are getting into your réserve climatique, or is it volatile?
I have a feeling that it goes on and off, because when we talk to my grandmother, who is going to be 98 this year.
Wow.
She's got a great memory, and she still talks to us about specific years, which were very hard with very low production, and then other years, which we had a very massive production. So I have a feeling, talking to the older people, that it sort of comes back somehow. It goes on and off. But I can't find a correlation. What it's sure is that it's getting hotter. But then this summer we had half of the summer who was very hot, and the other summer, which was really bad.
Really cold.
Really cold. So I'm not sure there's actually a correlation. If you ask another producer, they're probably going to say completely the opposite. This is more like a feeling.
Yeah, I kind of see the question in two parts. Like, one is the effect, like, how is the quota affected, like the demand implied by the quota, how is that affected? And then, like, what is the effect of a possible changing of the environment around here where we have the growth? I think the quota is more driven just by market demand. The quota historically in the last 10 years was not, you know, always going up, but there was more demand from the world for cognac. And so the demand on the buy side was such that the quota got bigger. And then now, you know, it's like Therese said, it's like a pendulum. And so, like, the pendulum is not swinging as hard to the demand anymore, because they kind of built up a reserve themselves, in a sense. So like, that's for the quota. And then with the growing, I mean, to Terry's observation of the old timers, like, you know, there's the hail of 72, you know, or like the late frost of 56 or whatever. Like, you know, there always is.
There's always been tragic years, yes.
Right.
And great years.
Right. Because we just had a lot of flooding here, and like they're comparing it to like the storm of 99 or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's positioned geographically makes it a tricky region, climatically speaking. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So we're going to get to the cognac in just a second, but I wanted to ask another question, maybe for you, Thérèse, that there was a book published about a year ago called The Women of Cognac, and I hear it's now translated into English.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about this book, what it means to you, what it means for the region?
Yes, this is an amazing book that has been written by Monique Filliou, who the mother of Christophe Filliou, who's a very well-known producer. And she's a writer, and she decided one day that women were not put enough into the light. And so she decided to just gather a profile of different women, some she knew, some she had heard of, and tried to gather together also different areas of the cognac world, which means barrel makers, distillers, master sellers, cellars. So all of these women are represented into this one single book, which is called The Women of Cognac. And it's very interesting because you can learn a lot about the cognac production throughout the profile of each woman. And you can also see what these women have been going through, which is absolutely amazing. And there are also different ages, women who have been in the cognac world for all their entire life, and they're about 70 or 80. And then there are young people, which are hardly 25. And there's middle people like me. And you can actually see their backgrounds. A lot of them have done amazing studies. And because sometimes, you know, you think, oh, what do? You live in the countryside, you do X and X job. And people think that you've done nothing before. And when you read this book, you're so amazingly surprised about the different profiles of all these different women. So I'd say this is a great book for anyone who'd like to learn about cognac throughout the profile of these amazing women.
That's really cool. And it's great, a great move that it's been translated to English, I think. That will open up this universe to a lot more people. So.
You have to think that women were not necessarily the front face of all these cognac houses. These cognac houses were mostly represented by men in general. And the women behind were sometimes even the ones that were actually moving the entire estate, that were making things happen, that had the social skills to bring and put people together. And this is great because, unfortunately, we can't, you know, put every single woman into this book. But if we could at least put some of them, it's also a reference and a like a little blink of the eye. I don't know how to say this in English.
Wink.
Well, yes, right. To all of these women that have made these cognac houses what they are now.
Yeah.
And all of these women, a lot of them have passed away. And it's a little bit in honor to all of these women that are not with us today.
Yeah, it's really great. I mean, I recently spoke with Annie Vagneau-Sabourin. And she just had nothing but fantastic things to say about the project, the book.
She's an incredible woman. When I met her, she has such wisdom. Yeah, I'm a big fan.
Very cool. Okay, so now we can talk about the cognac a little bit. So for the listeners who may just be getting their first introduction to this blend, the Sophie and Max Selection 3, what can you say about this particular cognac?
So this is going to be a 30, 35-year-old cognac. So it's on the order of what we would consider an XO here for us at Bertrand. It's going to have a slightly higher ABV than we find on the making air quotes, typical bottle of cognac at 40%. And this is a project that we did with Sophie and Max to create something that is interesting for people that want to discover cognac, that are looking for the experience of something which gives that nice roundness that you find of a 30 plus year old cognac, and just have it be something also very accessible, something that's very drinkable.
I was just going to say that. Drinkable. Gosh,
that was an objective.
This is something I heard before. One of our, I think it was a client who said, this is amazing. And then he said, this is very drinkable. And then I looked at Seth and I said, is this like a good thing or is this a bad thing? And I found myself drinking Sophie's and Mac's selections and thinking, oh my God, this is very drinkable. Right. So it is a good thing.
Yeah. I guess it could be a bad thing if you drink too much of it, but overall very positive.
Yeah.
So when they came to us with the project, I had a couple of cognacs that were put to the side as, say, like candidates to blend together for something that we would consider here, could be an IXO in the future. But instead of us making the decision about how we would put those two together, we put it to Sophie and Max to make the final decision about what they liked and what they wanted to express with.
So they sort of became the master seller, kind of.
So we put it together in different proportions and then had some dialogue to talk about what their impressions were of each blend, and then they made a decision.
Yes, right. There's a lot of the fans of this cognac.
Yeah, for sure. And if I understand correctly, it kind of sits, it's not correct to say in the middle, but somewhere near your normal XO and the Héritage, but closer to the XO, I would say. Is that a fair assessment?
Mm-hmm. He has a very nice...
In terms of the age and the experience.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay.
He has a very nice smoothness to it, and it doesn't have the aggressive notes that some drinkers may not understand when we're drinking cask strength.
Right.
Because strengths are amazing, but you need to have that kind of palate. And this cognac has a very nice approach to the alcohol, like to the...
Yeah, I think that's a good way to think about it. It's not at 40% ABV at 40 degrees. It's like a step from what you would find in like your standard range to something which is more like a cask strength experience. It's like a step in that direction.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Very clear. Okay. And then just to talk a little bit about some of the cellar and the barrel and all this stuff. So the cellar that you have at the estate, is it humid, dry, somewhere in between, would you say?
We actually have two. We have several cellars, but one is more humid, I'd say, and the other one is a bit more dry.
Yeah, I think it just has to do with where the building is located on the property. The ones that are...
Kind of the soil.
The ones that are closer to the house, I think, are going to have a little bit less humidity just because of where they're located. And then we have a large shay, which is down at a slightly lower elevation and set away from the house. And I think that one would tend to be a bit more humid because that's just where all of the watershed of the hill just kind of funnels down past that building.
Mm-hmm.
And the very bottom of that kind of collection point of the land is very close. So I would consider that to be one.
And do you recall for the two... eau de vie or the two cognacs that made up this blend, were they aging in the drier one or the more humid one, if you remember?
So one of them was in the more humid one, basically until we pulled it to consider it as a blend. And then the other one had been up here. I think it had been pulled just before we arrived, and it was being kind of moved in the direction of going into a blend, and we kept it in, it was in a, what's called a tonneau, which is one of the large ones. And it just, when we got here, it was like somebody put it there to get it on its way, but it wasn't ready yet. So 10 years later, it was ready.
The notion of time in the cognac region is crazy. Like 10 years, right, they talk about it like it's nothing.
Yeah, that's true. We talk about 10, 15, 20 years like it's nothing. You're absolutely true. Sometimes we forget how precious time is.
Yeah, but I think an interesting question to put to people, something that we think about a lot because of this increasing interest in the higher ABV stuff, the cask strength, is when do you decide that it's time to take it out of the barrel, right? Is it something where you are coaxing it, you're like working it towards an objective that you have in mind, or is it more about just following behind and waiting for it to say, hey, I'm ready, take me now?
I think both are correct. I think yeah. both.
I was going to say it's probably an impossible question, because then you could even debate, like, should a little bit of water be added? I suppose there are plenty of cognacs where a slight reduction actually improves things. Yeah. So,
and then you could go into, when do you add the water?
Yeah.
Like, do you add it in a very early stage, or do you add it? Obviously, the earliest is the better.
No, but like the hard part is that at the end of the day, the only way to know is to do it. And once you do it, there's no going back.
It's
right.
Yeah. Fair enough.
It's very esoteric, right?
Great. So I just want to talk quickly about barrels, not necessarily the barrels for this specific cognac, but just the barrels that you use in general at Bertrand. Can you say a little bit about what type of barrel, kind of show, do you favor new or old oak? Anything you could say about your barrel policy?
Weird. Well, sure. So cognac barrels are always made from French oak. That's a rule. So there are 5 or 6, I want to say, cooperages that we work with in
about
the area.
Six, yes.
There are a lot of cooperages everywhere. And we work with about 6, and we get new barrels every year. The cognac barrels are typically pretty heavily toasted. I mean, that's what we use here. I believe that's pretty general for the region, but I'm not going to plant my flag on that hill yet. But we get new barrels every year, and we use that to give the first dose of wood to the clear spirit. And kind of a rule of thumb with the aging, both with the wood and if you're going to manipulate the eau de vie, is that the younger it is and the more that like young, aggressive character it has, the more you can treat it a little bit more rough. Like, you can give it a very strong dose of wood. That's why you always put the clear spirit in a new barrel. If I've heard some people talk about, like, if you know that you're going to use this eau de vie for a bottling relatively young, then you might want to cut it down right away with some distilled water. And so, like, it's not unheard of to cut it from 70 to 60% right away. Yeah. But then you need a lot more barrels to store it in. It's a trade-off, right? All the clear spirit goes into a new barrel. We leave it for about a year. And then when we take it out, it's going to transition into an intermediate aged barrel in which the wood will continue to give, but not with the aggressive wood of a new barrel.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually the wood stops giving. Like, each year it gives a little bit less. And eventually that wood becomes effectively neutral. And we'll start to consider that as something like an old barrel. An old barrel is one where the wood itself doesn't give anymore, but it still lets the respiration work and the angels do their thing. And the shelf for the barrels, the toasting, is medium high. Okay. Moyen fort.
Moyen fort. Okay.
Brust. So that's kind of how it works with the wood, with the barrels.
And then, curious question, how much does a new barrel even cost? Can you share that?
A lot.
Like 1,000 euros, 800 euros?
A 400-liter barrel would be between 800-900 euros.
Yeah, I think so. It's really expensive.
Very expensive.
This is something that Terry's brother Samuel deals with. All of the sourcing of the barrels is
it used to be about 600-700, and now it's gone up.
It's like 800-900.
After 10 years,
Eight to nine hundred,
I'd say.
That's quite a budget then for a small producer who would want to add, I don't know, 10 to 15 barrels each year. Like,
yes.
That's not nothing.
But it's a huge budget, but it's an important budget.
Sure.
Yeah.
And it's happened to us that we bought several barrels from several barrel makers, and we put the same eau de vie, and we see the effect after 6 months, and the differences are huge. Even though it's the same type of heat, it's the same type of origin of wood, it has, the wood has dried a certain amount of times, about 3 years before it's put into a barrel. Even though we try to keep the same specifics, we still find so many differences.
That would be a fun project for 20 years, 30 years down the road. Just
keep
a barrel aside for each provenance.
But just remember that even inside a cellar, from one barrel to another, it's a huge difference. If you put a barrel next to the exit or the door, which you're going to be opening more often, there's going to be a lot more ventilation than a barrel that's going to be at the back corner of the cellar, which is going to have less ventilation. I mean, the amount of different, I'd say, ingredients to make this cognac, it's crazy. It's insane. Very different from one to another.
Yeah, okay. Fascinating. To your point about the investment required for barrels, I think it's good to note that there is a very big secondhand market for barrels. So each year you get new barrels and the barrel maker takes back the other barrels.
Gosh, it sounds like the barrel market is heading into this abonnement subscription direction, kind of like we see this popping up like in every aspect of our lives, you know, rent this, you know, Netflix and all these different subscriptions. Feels like the barrels are going in that direction.
Well, it's just that for cognac, we always required new barrels, and the effect of a new barrel goes down over time. After a couple of years in a new barrel, it doesn't give that same aggressive note. So you always need to have a new barrel, a new barrel. And so the long relationships that every producer has with their barrel makers is such that we use the barrel and then we turn the barrel back over to them. And it's like what you would call a buy sell. So it's not like you're always buying new barrels and keeping them. It's like you're selling the barrel you just used back to the producer who made it, and they're giving you a new one in exchange. And then they take that barrel and
sometimes resell it.
Sometimes they resell
beer makers.
They sell it to all kinds of other spirits, the world of spirits. Like, a lot of people want cognac barrels to do things with.
Right.
So, mm-hmm.
So it's like a car lease, kind of. And just leasing barrels, sort of.
A little bit, yeah. Yeah, it's kind of like that.
Well, it's like you take a brand new barrel, which has some value, but not that much. And then you've put cognac inside, and suddenly the value of it has increased because there was cognac in it. Yeah. That's how powerful cognac is.
yeah. Crazy. Okay. And then just to finish here, let's get back to the cognac. We can maybe just talk about a quick tasting note. I know it's a subjective thing, but some different notes for the nose and the palate and the texture would be cool.
Okay. So we think about, when we do our tastings, we have our four families. So we have the flowers, we have the fruit, we have the spices, and then we have the darker woody tones. And we try to think about it like that. I mean, we'll have some specific aromas, but it's a personal thing. We got to always keep that in mind. So first, we'll take a look at the color of it in the glass, because the older cognacs, they seem to have a nice light that comes from inside of them when you hold it up to the light. This is going to have bright tones, orange and tan. You could think of the color of amber or fine leather.
Polished copper.
Yeah. So then on the nose, we find that the nose is going to be flowers with fruit. And underneath, we get a little bit of spice. So some specific ideas, perhaps some vanilla, your shortbread. We have baking spices, a little bit of maybe citrus. But it's that mix of flowers and fruit with spices. And then on the palate, we're going to get the spice again, a lot stronger, the spice up front. And across the middle of the palate, we're going to get just that nice fruit, that stone fruit that we'll get in the older cognacs, and a little bit of citrus on the finish. And we feel like there's a little bit of floral notes throughout that whole thing, kind of riding underneath. We like to think it's roses, but you might have a different.
Yeah, well, ask two people for a tasting note on the same cognac, and you'll get often very different responses.
Right.
Yes. Well, we all have a different palate, different experiences, different everything. So it's normal.
Great. Okay. Well, as always, guys, I thank you very much for your time, and you're always thoughtful reflective answers to my questions. So again, thank you very much. Happy holidays. And I will certainly look forward to seeing you again and speaking and tasting stuff.
Thank you. Have a lovely holidays too. Sending best wishes to everybody who's listening. Take care.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Merci.
Thank you for listening to the Cognac Expert Calendar podcast. Tomorrow is another day, another cognac.